Hello and welcome to This Anthro Life. I'm your host, Adam Gamwell. And some of my favorite topics of conversation on this podcast are around business anthropology and using the anthropological toolkit to help solve world problems. And as I was getting to know the world of anthropologists who work in business, Grant McCracken's name was one of the first. When I found his book, Chief Culture Officer, I was transfixed, not only with the idea of crusading to get more anthropologists in executive positions, but more generally, with how interesting and important it is to take the time to understand and turn my anthropological lens to my own cultural worlds, not just those of others. Grant's writings have helped me realize that if we want to have a hand in shaping the world, we need to get to work on our own culture. So I can say that it was more than a treat to get to talk with Grant about how his approach to American anthropology and career in the corporate and consulting sectors has brought about a number of provocative ideas, such as in his new book, The New Honor Code. Now, in The New Honor Code, Grant draws together ideas from Elizabethan England in his own PhD research, insights found while hanging out in people's living rooms, interviewing them about television watching habits for a client that you might have heard of, called Netflix, the rise of celebrity culture as the closest thing we have to honor today, and why that's a problem, and the seemingly uncrossable gap between American boomers and millennials and Gen Z. In mixing all of these ideas together, he asks, what is honor? Why did it seem to disappear from our culture? And what would it look like to create a system of honor today in the contemporary United States that would dissuade people from acting badly with impunity? You know, all those rich, powerful, mostly men who think they can do whatever they want and get away with it. We dig into all these topics in this episode, and Grant has some great advice for any social scientist looking to go into consulting or business, or if you're in business, how we can be more savvy and practical about infusing anthropological mindsets thinking into organizations without hitting people over the head with it, especially if they find the idea of culture confusing. In my own personal journey, I took heart to also learn that Grant struggled with figuring out how to define himself as an anthropologist and what anthropology looks like out in the business world. And as someone else who's moved out of academia into being a problem solver for business, I took a lot away from this conversation, and I think you will too. Let's enjoy.
So to kick things off, Grant has a really interesting origin story in that he has both done kind of traditional anthropological education, but then has then decided to make the move into business consulting. And that really led to a really interesting flourishing of both writing. And even you mentioned this in the New Honor Code, that there was opinions and perspectives from the Chicago crowd of anthropologists when you decided to make the move. And also one of the pieces you mentioned there that was interesting was that you like put your consulting money back into research. So even that kind of conversation I think is quite interesting. Right. So I'd love to hear a bit about your own path and process of how you went from, I don't know if it's academic anthropology, but just training at least in the academic side into the business world and like how that conversation happened.
Okay. I was working at the Royal Ontario Museum. I was running an Institute of Contemporary Culture, and it was just tough sledding to get anything done. Took too many committee meetings. And I did a little consulting enough to see that, in fact, I didn't have to stay at the museum. I had tenure there, but I thought, you know what, this consulting enables me to pay my own way, as it were, become a kind of self-funding anthropologist. So that's what I decided to do. I was really conflicted about it. I thought, this is morally objectionable, and this is wrong for all the reasons that people held certain kinds of consulting in contempt, and I was terrified that they were right. Anyhow, I persevered, and yes, in fact, that turned out to be the case, that I could consult half the year and that would make enough money to sustain me for the course of the year. And in fact, I thought that some of the stereotyping or some of the ways people thought about consulting turned out to be wrong, not least because these institutions were vastly less manipulative. They weren't captains of consciousness, as I think it was Ewan used to call them. They were clueless and often earnest, and they just couldn't manufacture the false consciousness that everybody took to be their objective. I remember at a cocktail party that I attended in Montreal, I think it was, but there were several Chicago people there, one of whom had risen to great heights in the AAA. And I was just then thinking I'd been offered a position at the Harvard Business School, and I thought, oh, that's going to be so interesting. The only way I'm going to get into the Harvard Business School is by teaching there. And so I mentioned this over drinks, just the two of us in conversation in a room filled with people talking. And she just broke off the conversation and walked away. I had clearly said something that was just so deeply objectionable that I had disappeared socially. She had erased me from this occasion. I think nobody ever asked, but I think the prevailing assumption was that you did what I was doing in order to make a fortune. And what you were doing effectively was selling your anthropology for the purposes of personal aggrandizement. And that wasn't true, because my model said that I made enough money in half a year to pay for the other half of the year to engage in research in the other half of the year. And that would exhaust the money. So I would be, some point halfway through the year, I'd be relatively wealthy, but by the end of the year, I'd be broke again. So the notion that I was feathering my nest in this way was just wrong. And what I began to see was, and it's impossible actually to pick apart where one thing starts and the other stops, but as I fell out of the academic orbit, my anthropology began to change. And I thought, this has to be one of the big advantages of getting anthropologists out of the academic world, that there is a gravitational field, that people tend to hew to a set of conventions, and that it makes lots of sense to get us out. I could feel my own interests and approaches begin to change. So that's how the thing played out.
That's really interesting. So it is important to highlight the fact that we do actually need to dismantle, I think, some of the narrative that is, you're just leaving the academy to go make a fortune, as if the academy lives somehow not also in the economy, in the capitalist world itself. But, you know, that's a different debate for a different time. But I think, interestingly here, the idea that your anthropology changed, and if we had to hazard a guess, of course, one of them is probably that the time scale of the research might change.
Right.
Maybe. But what else? So tell us, what are some of the characteristics that you found when your anthropology started to change in the business world?
I guess I began to care less about what other anthropologists thought were important questions and just begin to follow my own nose. And there was just so much. You would do a project for somebody, a bank or something, and they would ask you to talk to the consumer. And so you'd find yourself sitting in somebody's living room talking about, you know, these fabulously abstract things called money and retirement and savings and what was a family and how did you plan for it and how did money come into it. Anytime you asked any question for any commercial client, you ended up gathering just bags of data for every other purpose. You always had just a superabundance of data on hand, which is to say, you had at least the illusion that you were watching American culture. Every ethnographic interview was yet another window on the great breadth of American culture and all of the dynamism and improvisation taking place within it. And of course, I was a kid in the candy store. It was like, what's that? And what's that? And you think, what? And then you did what? You know, I might have fallen out of the anthropological orthodoxy in any case, but certainly lured by these temptations. You know, the temptations were not financial. They were ethnographic. And then to go back to drinks at the senior common room, at some university or other, and hear people just trot out the old stereotypes was now no longer annoying. It was increasingly odd, because it was not just wrong. It stood as a barrier preventing people, anthropologists, from participating in the study of their own culture. It was all there, right? All this data was simply, you know, literally all you had to do was open your front door, whatever that was, march down the street and engage almost anybody in conversation. And you would discover that the favorite ideas that anthropologists had cultivated as an understanding of American culture were probably wrong. And something vastly more interesting was taking place. So I began to grow. For a while, I was apologetic and self-accusing. And I had this sense that, oh my God, you know, perhaps I've got this really badly wrong. I'm fallen not just out of intellectual orbit, kind of moral orbit too. And then I thought, no, actually, there may be some truth there. But the larger truth surely is that I'm getting to see something that is the Shangri-La effect, right? There's something happening there that is is being denied my colleagues by dint of their own way of constructing the world.
I love that. And I resonate with the idea too of, particularly as one that's starting out, like, does one need to feel apologetic? The flip side is really what you're saying too, reminds me of Margaret Mead in her own kind of crucible, to use a dramatic term, I guess, of just saying, no, we actually have to study American culture, particularly in her case. I really like that she said, because America is not mature enough to run the world, which I still think is the case, you know, yeah. But she was willing to endure that. And so I think that this is quite interesting to notice the same thing here, where it's just like, there is a narrative that one has to go against. However, I really like the way that you frame it as it's literally just stepping out of your own front door and recognizing that there's such both a wealth of knowledge of actually how American culture actually happens, but then the flip side, that a lot of the social scientists whose job it is and whose expertise is understanding and documenting the human condition don't seem to get their own backyards or front doors in this case, which is when you pause to say it that way, it's wow, we owe it to ourselves, I think, to try to get some of this right. You know, when I first found your work was with Chief Culture Officer, you wrote a number of years ago, that was, what does it mean to bring culture into the C-suite on the highest echelons of business? And then now you're working on this new book, that's the new honor code, that's this like broader perspective that ties in from your original PhD research, which I want to talk a bit about. And how does culture help us rethink, in this case, honor? Like, what's gone off the rails in US and a lot of Western society too, in terms of people just acting badly with impunity, certainly in the C-suite, but then on top of that, we're just seeing it politically and things like celebrity culture. And so, but I want to hear a bit about like how that process happened for you, that you were thinking about, you know what, there's this thing that I looked at for PhD research, that besides watching The Crown, realizing there's something happening here that we need to perhaps rethink about.
My PhD work had me studying the Elizabethan period, Elizabethan England, for a couple of years. And as an anthropologist will, you soak yourself in the data, and you come to think about the world as they think about the world. And so occasionally I would, looking at contemporary culture, think, especially struck by the thing that you just pointed out, that the bad behavior is apparently costless. There's a nice quote in that I found for the book from a woman who worked at a big media house. She was assaulted by a big name in the entertainment biz. As she was walking down a hallway, this guy just came up behind her and groped her. And the journalist asked her about it, and she said, the tone is just heartbreaking. She says, oh, in those days, they just did what they wanted to you. And it was so, you could feel her disgust, but you could also feel her resignation and think, what is the matter with a culture that has any pretensions to moral probity, actually creating an office place in which that behavior could happen, but that the victim should be obliged then to accept it with this, complacency is the wrong word, but resignation, I guess, is the right one. Anyhow, so that was, I thought that wouldn't have happened in the Elizabethan case. So I'm being an economistic kind of calculation. Could we create a culture in which there is this fungible thing called honor, the loss of which costs you and your standing in the contemporary world? You know, if noble behavior were going to happen, it would have happened. So at this point, I think we're reduced to just trying to change the playing field so that people feel that if they don't have something to gain morally, we have to make it that they have something to lose in order to protect that woman in the New York media biz.
Yeah, that's a really interesting idea too, in that it has a level of historical precedence, as you said. And also, I like the phrasing that if we were going to be honorable, we would have done it by now, or would have been like fundamentally only good or only bad. We'd have done that by now, but it's like we're just quite a gray species in this case, that we have capacity for great good and for great evil. And so it really is about the kind of roles and rules and regulations that we set for ourselves, or that we might call culture, right?
And this isn't in the book, but it maybe ought to be. We created this quite poisonous system called celebrity culture, and which I talk about in the book because it's so obviously the competitor against an honor culture. But the key thing here is, I think, those people in that New York firm we're talking about, the media giant, were behaving that way because they were famous. And fame, it's to some extent, it's maleness plus fame that creates these monsters. But all of this is to say there is that kind of tension between fame and honor. And because we've seen so many people actually accomplish fame by destroying their honor, you know, spectacular acts of self-display. You think about the Kardashian sisters and sex tapes and things that would have been, you know, removed you from being a credible social actor, actually helped create a celebrity for some of those people. And so there's that, yeah, there's that tension.
That was actually a really interesting part of the book too. One of the things that you do is you trace some of the different historical movements. And this is like the rise of celebrity culture as well as the avant-garde before that. And that was like, you know, we may think about the hippie movement. That might've been things like, let me try a lot of psychedelic drugs or free love as ways to like move past conventions of authority. But I think there's another piece too that has really struck me about the way that you're framing this. This also comes from the book as a small spoiler alert. But just seeing the idea of Swift peoples, the idea is like 1950s family of always trying to get ahead, which is not the hippie idea. But like I think hippies are trying to get away from this idea. And it's not just about trying to get ahead. And then there is, to me, almost this like Zen-ish sounding idea, let us treasure the now, right? And it seems on one level too, like even the artisanal moment that you bring up, the idea of artisanship is also a response to this in terms of how do we bring a bit more of slow making and like locality and here-ness, that there's nothing to escape from, which is quite interesting. And it seems like that is perhaps then the most fertile ground for us to rethink this idea of honor, because it's now that it's almost like if we can get people to be here, not trying to get away or not trying to get ahead, I don't know. I get that you set the timeline up this way, but at the same time, this feels almost like a natural inflection point in which honor can find more fertile ground.
Yeah. Yeah. So I wrote something on the 1954 Buick, and I forget the title exactly, but it's something about Raymond Loewy in the 1954 Buick. And what was interesting about that historical moment is that he was charged with bringing a kind of modernism to the redesign of the American automobile. And Studebaker thought this would be fantastic. And the American public were horrified by his design, and it had to be yanked from the marketplace. And again, as an anthropologist, right, this is just grist for our mill. We're looking at this like, if only I were Nancy Munn looking at Trobriand canoes. But this is exactly a Nancy Munn Trobriand canoe moment, right? It's just looking at these magnificent and extraordinarily odd instruments in people's driveways and all the things they meant to those people and how they caught up a whole series. I mean, it's this beautiful series of layering going on here where the whole of the culture is in several quite different particulars, all bad metaphor here, marching to the same drum. They're all caught up in this same sense of motion and progress and movement. And yeah, that was the thing to think about, is that's when people, it seemed to me, were most Americans were deeply happy with this idea that they were swift creatures, that they were in constant motion. And it was that motion in social space and emotional space and domestic space that they where things went best, when you had this sense of motion and movement, and especially upward ascent in the social scheme of things. Anyhow, and what does Baudrillard say? The best way to see America is in a rear view mirror as you rocket down the highway. That's the defining understanding of American culture, which works beautifully. So you're working that, you're hearing people talk about swiftness. They never use that language, but I have to tell you, of all the modest efforts at phrase making I've engaged in doing the study of American culture, that term really speaks to people, and they repeat it almost instantaneously. Mm. And this is people, especially living in the corporation, in the middle class, and in creatures of privilege, love this idea of swiftness.
One of the things that struck me about this too, I thought was quite interesting, is that this is kind of a generational divide also, like, because you do talk about the idea of millennials versus boomers as like in a bit of a different context, but just like a bit about how do we communicate with each other. And partially because worldviews are different. And we grew up in these different spaces where there is like the Swift self might define the boomer. And the millennial self, I think on some levels, is still being defined. The other idea too that I'd add to this equation that you also mentioned in the book is the idea that, you know, popular culture, we just need to drop the adjective from popular culture. It's just culture. And how boomers have typically treated television and, you know, what we call pop culture just as like noise, right? As fluff. It's not the real stuff. But then you kind of pointed the argument that actually, no, this is the real, this is culture. And so part of it is, how do we, like, coming to take that seriously, I guess. How did you see that kind of playing out?
I had always had suspicion studying American culture, especially after World War two, you can't fail to notice the chorus of skepticism that came from people like Galbraith and Minow and a whole series of Ewan and a whole series of people set themselves up as critics of the American middle class and really scorned suburban life, especially that suburb that appears after World War II. And especially Galbraith just goes at them. It's just astounding. You think, gee, as a Canadian, I know where Galbraith is from. He's playing up Brahmin manners without a warrant, which is always interesting. Anyhow, so that finds its way into studies of TV. And so when Minow in 61, I think, is appointed by Kennedy to look at television and assess its cultural significance, he's the guy who says, listen, this is a vast wasteland. Nothing good can come of this. And the intellectuals loved this. The academics ate it up and wrote books about dumbing down. And this was now the standard issue orthodoxy about popular culture, that it was bad, that it was stupefying, that it would. And so when people began to consume Netflix television, they began to apologize for it. When people said, so what are you doing? Isn't that's a bit weird, watching all that TV? They said, oh, yeah, well, no, we're binging. And it was a way for them to apologize for behavior that in their hearts they believed to be dubious. And what they were doing is playing out what the intellectuals and the academics had told them was true of American middle-class culture, that it was dumb and stupid and undemanding and indulgent. So the good news here is, and this is the blessing that awaits an anthropologist who does a study of the contemporary world for commercial clients. In this case, the client was Netflix. So I'm now able to use their resources and their magical word, Netflix, would get you in almost anywhere. So now I'm interviewing people sitting in their living room, talking to them about how they watch TV. And what they talk about, what they're not telling me is that they're sitting there drooling, overfed with bad TV. They're not watching The Dukes of Hazzard. And in point of fact, lots and lots of TV got better. And you could see a systematic breaking of the basic rules of the contract that TV had fashioned between the viewer and the showrunner, one of which was keep it simple, stupid. That rule died early. Another rule was, oh, that bad things must never happen to the hero or the character. And that began to, especially in the last sort of 8 years, now it's routinely the case that people will kill off the character who would normally be preserved from. So the whole set of rules that were now being violated, they were making a better, more interesting TV, but people were still inclined to use the metaphor. And my sense was it really was a bad act of metaphor, that in fact, these people weren't binging, they were feasting. And you could see this happen. So again, bless Netflix. They sent me to London and Rio and Mexico City and all over the world to talk to people, and they're telling the same story. They're just completely enamored how interesting TV is. And you can see that this discussion of this TV is now what dominates the Saturday evening that used to be taken up with talking about mortgages and other banal issues, that people couldn't wait to have these conversations. And a whole set of social effects, including one woman who said, look, this is the way I figure out who I want to go out with. I have a brief preliminary conversation with a guy, and he has to like the shows I like. He has to like them in the way I like them. He has to be able to talk about the kinds of issues with kind of intelligence and sensitivity. And that's how I know who I'm dealing with. That tells me vastly more than any sorting dating app could ever do. And so just interesting to watch people had risen to the opportunity that streaming TV made available to them. And they rose to the intellectual challenges, the emotional challenges that these shows made available to them. But they hadn't actually embraced a cultural shift. They were continuing to play out these metaphors of apology and embarrassment and self-criticism.
I love that metaphor. So that raises this challenge then, that the idea of binging versus feasting is the idea that entertainment and TV is just trash and noise. And this is partially what kind of what we're seeing and what you set up in the book too, is partially this, a bit of a generational divide about what art right. is good for. And then, so how does this play into what the honor code would be then? So if we're trying to put these pieces together, it's that it seems to me like we're trying to get a more realistic picture of what American culture, if there is not obviously not a monolithic thing, but like what American culture actually is experientially for people and how they live it. And so it seems that one piece, right, has been that's the idea of honor in terms of that people can act without impunity, but then it like filters into these interesting ideas that entertainment is worthless or not so great. And that leads to sort of a that millennials aren't necessarily always truthful with boomers and how they perceive the world. And that has a double problem of giving away, saying boomers, you have your perspective and like so the boomers think the world operates the way they think it does, but right. then also it then effaces or hides millennial culture too. So there's this interesting tension yeah. too of like, how do we have a more honest conversation across generations or different class groups even? How does that play into the question of honor?
Yeah. Yeah, the issue for what does anthropology bring to the party? It's this extraordinary ability to work on with this thing called culture and to listen for it and to detect it and to hear tiny movements and to be able to say what that could mean in the longer term. I mean, that's our gift. But it is the thing that's extraordinarily difficult to make visible in the world of the American organization. And it's such a chronic difficulty that I now, speaking of metaphors, tend to think about culture as the kind of dark energy of the American experiment. People know it's out there. They know it's important, but they don't know how to think about it. And that's, I think, that's problematical, especially for... So the grimmest outcome here is that the organization is on the verge of making a decision about some communication or active innovation or whatever they're doing. And they say, somebody in the room can be relied upon to say, let's figure out let's ask the intern what she thinks. Because they know they don't know culture and they know that other generations do know culture. And they're now, this puts them in the position of having to ask somebody they're not paying to help them make a decision that falls squarely in their professional competence. They really should know what it is they're dealing with here. And not to know is, I think, a shocking kind of abrogation of their responsibility. Anyhow, which is why I wrote the Chief Culture Officer. I thought, if you're never going to embrace this idea called culture, at least put somebody in the C-suite who knows about culture. And this would be perfect, right? This is Gen X and Y are ready for their close-up, right? They would take these jobs up beautifully. And the corporation looked at the book and thought long and hard and then said, no, we're not going to do this. We don't want to have somebody who knows about culture in the C-suite. That would be extremely annoying. And so I failed on that one. But that's, I think, what's happening in this part of the book. I'm talking to a woman who's implying that she's lying to the people she's just been talking to at a Christmas party. And I say, lying? And she looks at me like I'm slightly dim, pretty close to the truth of the matter, and reveals that, of course, she's lying. She's always lying when talking to boomers because she has to have her view of the world, which accepts that culture exists, and then she has to have a different view of the world for boomers because they're just so deeply stupid and stubborn and incapable of grappling with certain issues, culture being just one of those. That's on us. I should speak for myself. That's on boomers, this failure to get serious about the topic. And I guess it'll change, but I thought it would have changed well before this.
That's interesting. I guess also in part because capital can move both fast and slow, right? And so when it comes to a corporation and structure, you know, it seems like that they would be reticent to change because obviously, like, if taking in the idea of culture should radically alter the way that people consider business practices, what might be good for people, or how do ideas flow even? And so but the idea is much easier to segment people into, like, just the Gen Zs do that, or multicultural millennials do this or that. And it's like, because it simplifies it. However, it's right that the ethnography points out that culture, of course, crisscrosses all of these labels that we use too. So it is really interesting to think about how do we both take seriously that these things crisscross, but there are also, of course, both class or generational, divides that we set up that we have to work across also. And who knows? Maybe businesses will change in the future in terms of embracing more culture. It seems like you might see startups doing that much more, like a smaller, newer organization, but Yeah. Curious, like with something like Netflix, which is a global organization now that isn't that old, 20 years maybe. Yes. Yeah. You know, I don't know. Yeah. We're in an interesting inflection point, I think, in terms of like how business might change over the next 20 years from now, even in terms of as C-suite leadership changes, like will we see culture become one of the equations a little bit more?
Totally. And from your lips to God's ears. But I think it's remotely possible that culture is just the thing I insist is just the term I insist on using and other people insist on. And I now do this more and more in my professional practice is I just talk about problems. And the solutions are soaked with cultural understandings because that's the way I think. But the client doesn't ever have to hear that word. And in fact, is happiest if they don't hear that word. And maybe that's the longer term kind of accomplishments, that it will just work a cultural sophistication into problem solving and we'll just cease to use it altogether. Because that was the striking thing to learn from an intern I had when working at the museum. He was talking about a Hollywood blockbuster and he wasn't embarrassed about it. And I thought, wow, that is so interesting. And he said, look, it's just, it's not popular culture. It's just culture. That adjective has cost us so dear that the moment you call it popular culture, the journalism gets goofy, the boomers get scornful, every kind of barrier to taking it seriously rises up. Yeah, maybe we just dispense with it altogether. I don't know.
That's a really fascinating idea. It's funny because this similar debate about should we just drop the term, it all happened 30 years ago.
Did it?
Like when George Marcus was writing the book Writing Culture, about should we just not use the culture concept because it's just, it's like too overloaded and too overstuffed.
Oh, like, that's great.
But obviously it didn't go away. It's still here.
Yeah.
But however, thinking about it in the business context is a really interesting other way to ask us this question of solving problems. And actually, obviously, the solutions themselves are soaked in cultural reality. So actually that idea too, I think is something that is quite valuable about your work too, that is I wanted to tag onto is just that this is one of the values I think that anthropology has that folks, if they're in the academy or obviously if they're in business more, but helping people realize that anthropology is actually quite an excellent toolkit for solving problems, right?
Right.
And how folks can come to see that, I guess, is an answer I still wrestle with. And that's partially why I did the podcast, too, is that we're framed around the idea of anthropology is there to help us solve problems. You know, that it's like it is actually one of the best toolkits we have for both understanding people and the ethnographic interview, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. So what are your thoughts on that, too? It's a problem solver. How do we get people more used to it being that, I guess?
I guess the happiest moments for me in my consulting life are the brainstorm. You get lots of people in a room and they just start blabbing. And that's when you feel ideas pulled out of you by this collective rush to revelation, right? Everybody can feel the idea rising and bad ideas are proposed, but they fall away all on their own. And it's just this kind of, it's a feast, to use that metaphor again. And that's problem solving. I'm not using anything that's obviously anthropological, but everything I do in the analysis and especially in the creativity is anthropological. So when I was at MIT, I was trying to persuade students there that we should think of ourselves as assumption hunters, that what anthropologists do, and I wasn't talking in this case to anthropologists, I was talking to media students. The first thing that anthropologists knows about culture is that it's deeply embedded, always active, but largely invisible. And that what we're good at is seeing those invisible assumptions and mechanics and logics and bringing them to the surface. So let's think of ourselves as assumption hunters. So I think that's just the argument I would make for if anybody cares what I think, young anthropologists is go to it, get engaged in these brainstorms and just conduct yourself, give yourself to the joy that is that conversation, and your anthropological training will inform what you do. You'll be better at what you're doing for the fact of your anthropological training, but maybe don't use anthropological language or even logic. Just rise to the intellectual occasion, and you'll be better and smarter and more creative for the fact that you trained as an anthropologist. But you will have, in all of those moments of engagement, you will put all this distance between who you were and who you're becoming. And I think that's that was terrifying for me. I was talking early in the conversation about this idea of maybe it's right, maybe an anthropologist shouldn't do consulting. And as I could feel myself kind of whipsawing back and forth between worlds, what was the metaphor I used to use? Yes, that I was riding uneven circus ponies, that I was constantly moving back. And eventually, that's the reassurance that we can give young anthropologists is free fall. Give yourself over to these intellectual occasions. Don't try to impose an anthropological view, and it will transform you as an anthropologist. But your anthropology, I think, will get better for the fact that it's taken place in this radically different context that makes no provision for the fact that there's an anthropologist in the room. So I think that's a tough thing for people to embrace, but the benefits are extraordinary, I think, because it's just so much fun to do some of this work.
Yeah, and that really resonates with me too. And I think what I'm taking from the conversation now is that it's important for us to realize too that anthropology is big enough and strong enough to take a remaking. Yeah. It's not going to not become anthropology.
And
I think that like it's interesting because one has to go through some training to understand what it is to practice anthropology, but then at the same time, like when you get there, you realize that it's a bunch of Lego bricks that you can configure in any way.
Yes.
But it's still going to be anthropology.
Exactly.
As long as you give it over. Yeah.
I think we could now look forward to some point in which we look back at the academic version of anthropology and think about it as our academic captivity, to use slightly biblical language, that was a moment when anthropology was profoundly shaped by those sherry parties and by the tenure process and the teaching, and that it's a glorious experiment when that breaks free and enters different contexts and shot through with moral difficulties, to be sure, but enormous opportunities in the field. And again, I can't separate how much of me is an anthropologist and how much of me is just somebody who would think like this in any case, but to the extent that that my example is useful for other anthropologists, I think we can say, you know, it's difficult and painful, but once you make the transition, it's pretty interesting to see what anthropological ideas can do in these new circumstances. And even when you think, is this still anthropology? I think I'm absolutely an anthropologist down to the ground. But other people might say, this guy is totally no longer working within any acceptable definition of the term.
Sounds like an anthropologist to me, so. I love that idea too. I empathize and celebrate with that idea just because it's also where I'm at personally. But also I think a lot of our listeners too are trying to figure out this, like, where is their own place in the world anthropologically, but perhaps also just for career choices. And I always find like some of the most fascinating conversations are in this precise realm where it is like we're pushing the boundaries of what we know to be anthropology in new spaces and just applying it in old spaces in new ways or taking old ideas and trying to put them in new ways. And that, to me, almost is even what the kind of work you're doing with New Honor Code is that also, right? We're taking an old idea and repackaging it in a way that like that works in a new landscape.
Yeah.
And I think is the example of the value of anthropological thinking. And pick your where you want it to land is fine. Like you can land in quote popular culture, in actual culture, in an organization, in an academy. Like to me, still recognizably anthropological, I guess is a way to say that. I think that so there is it is a kind of worth us pondering over, I think at some point in the future, what are the hallmarks that we now can say, we can point to something and say, oh, that still is anthropological, right?
Yeah. And I think we could use an empirical measure that says that this is anthropology, or at least not something else. Because when I make a presentation of my work, you'll often get people going, these are people who have their engineers or their MBAs, they're whatever they are, and they're very smart and they're very clear and they're very good at thinking. And when you give them something anthropological, they're entirely prepared to accept that it is anthropological because it's just so new and interesting and useful to them. So that's maybe one way to reassure ourselves that we haven't just abandoned the project.
Yeah, that's a good point. And also just the desire to carry the torch forward, right? From different projects I've done in design research consulting and just other client work, the other truth that we know is that if we don't point out what some of these pieces are, some of these hallmarks of anthropology, other people will do it. You'll see all the time like a designer saying, oh, I'm an anthropologist. And you're like, you have a degree in design.
Right.
And you may have read one or two books about anthropology, and that's fine.
Yeah.
But like to call yourself that or say this is anthropological, we can also see there's some boundaries that need to be like mentioned, because I wouldn't walk in and say I'm a designer if I never had training, right, or done work on that.
Exactly. I was just, in fact, I don't know, 6 months ago or something, IDEO published a great statement of who they are and what they stand for. And they managed never to use the word culture. And I thought, wow, that is really weird that they ought not to. And I started looking at the design statements of all the big design houses, and nobody was using the term culture. And I thought, this is like a physicist never using the term energy, or an economist never talking about value. It is the most fundamental thing. Anyhow, so I had a look. The guy who founded design thinking uses the term culture like 8 times in a 20-page paper. So it was there at the beginning, but it got edited out. And I mentioned this to people at IDEO and in other design houses, you know, what gives? You guys are claiming the mantle of intellectual leadership, talking about design thinking, but you're never talking about culture. Surely that's wrong. And some people were gentle in their pushback. And one guy was a guy I enormously admire intellectually, was just unbelievably hostile. He said, this is your special thing, this thing called culture, whatever that is, was the implication. And so you're trying to get everybody to care about it because that would be good for your career. And I thought, you son of a bitch, that's not, forgive my language, but that is that the way intellectuals behave when challenged? I don't think so. So he actually made it worse, right? Somebody sort of politely, in a very Canadian way, said, what about this? He said, no, we don't think about that. That's your personal preoccupation. So I agree with you entirely. I think we're entitled to say, what about culture?
I think that's the question.
Yeah.
Cool, Grant. I want to say thank you. This has been an amazing conversation.
My pleasure. Really, thank you so much. And thank you for indulging me in the walk and talk opportunity. That's just critical to the way I think. So thank you for that.
Once again, many thanks to Grant McCracken for taking the time out to talk about his new book, The New Honor Code, as well as share a ton of his wisdom that he's learned over the years. If you noted that last thing where he just said, thanks for indulging him in walking, we actually tried a new method where we used a remote recording thing using Anchor, and Grant was able to walk and talk on his phone. So it's actually kind of cool. So we did a literal mobile remote podcast recording. So if you are interested in being a guest on the podcast and you prefer to walk and talk, we have the technology. Once again, thanks for listening. I am Adam Gamble. Today's episode was produced by myself and Luciani Shans de Fonseca. So many thanks to your help for that. We are super excited to be bringing you a ton of amazing content this year. We're going to be hearing from MacArthur genius Mary Gray on ghost work in Silicon Valley, Gillian Tett on media and journalism, Paul Stoller on writing for non-academic audiences, and John Hardigan on how multi-species ethnography helps us understand ourselves better, especially in the Anthropocene. That's just a small preview of what we've got coming, so stay tuned, stick around, and we will see you soon.